The date is May 9, 2008. We're at the Atlantic Coast Federal Bank, 8th and Center Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Roger Alanda Henderson. He's born March 13, 1948 in Knoxville, Tennessee. My name is Frank Reitinger, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Okay, Roger, take it and head out.
Okay, it was the summer of 1967, I believe. And I was back in Orlando, Florida, going to Orlando Junior College. And I was out of phase, as several of us were back then, which meaning we weren't where we should have been in college at the proper time due to probably partying too much and not getting good grades. So therefore, I received a letter from our federal government saying they wanted me to go to Jacksonville, Florida for an induction physical. Well, from those that I had known that had these before, if you didn't join up one of the militaries, then you are automatically going to be inducted into the United States Army Infantry Division. And I really didn't want to be in the infantry. So I went down and talked to a recruiter there in Orlando, Florida, and I said, what can I do? First of all, I went into the Army, and I told the recruiter, what can I do? I want to fly helicopters, because I had a student pilot's license at the time and loved to fly, and he said, I can pretty much guarantee you that I can get you into Army helicopter flight school. What I cannot guarantee you is that the Army won't draft you before I can get you into flight school. And I said, I'm not willing to take that gamble. So I thanked him and walked down the hall to the Air Force recruiter and said, I like airplanes. I want to at least be around airplanes, but I need, you know, a definite guarantee here that I'm not going to end up in the infantry. So he said, we can take care of that. That's not a problem. Painted a very rosy picture, which I think most recruiters do. So he said, you'll still have to go for the physical, but we did all the paperwork. And he said, we're going to put you in the delayed enlistment program, because I said, I'd really like to spend the summer at home before I go. He says, good, we'll put you in the delayed enlistment program. Your enlistment will start, I think, like in May of 68, I believe, for actual counting. But he said, you won't actually have to report to duty to August. I said, good, I'll get to stay home and have some fun. So sure enough, I was enlisted in the Air Force. And in August, I had to report to Jacksonville, Florida again, where we completed some final paperwork, and I was put on a bus, taken out to the airport, got on an airplane, and went to Amarillo, Texas. Arrived in Amarillo, Texas, again, in August 1968. Lackland Air Force Base in Texas was where most Air Force recruits went through basic training. But due to Vietnam, I guess, having so many of us that were having to go through basic, they were overloaded in at Lackland. So Amarillo was the place that they used for the overflow for all the inductees. So I did my 6 weeks basic training at Amarillo Air Force Base in the summer and fall. And I'll never forget being in the barracks. And, of course, I had been away at college and been away from home a couple of years, so that it wasn't that big a deal. But we had some guys there that first time they'd ever been away from home. And they put us in this barracks, and, of course, they're waiting for other airplanes to come in until everybody gets there, because there's two flights have to fill up this big barracks before we can actually start or complete our processing. So they just tell you, stay in your room, talk to one another, but be quiet. Well, I'll never forget that afternoon, you know, in Amarillo, you know, the wind whistles across that prairie, and you can hear the wind whistling, that woo sound through this barracks, and all you can hear is guys crying, and I thought, oh, my goodness, what have I got myself into here? And finally, at that night, I guess once everybody got in, this big tech sergeant walked in, and he politely, and I guess that's a nice way to put it, politely told us who was in charge. Would anybody like to question his authority? And we looked at him and go, no, you're in charge. Not a problem. So after 6 weeks of training there in that hot, I guess somewhat dry, drier than the humidity in Florida, we finished training, and they sent me on a bus up to Denver, Colorado. And that's where I completed 4 months of munitions maintenance training. They taught us how to prepare bombs and repair guns, but also how to load it on aircraft. Once you finished this school, you were either going to be in the maintenance section where you maintained bombs and guns, or you were going to be in the loading section where you were going to be on a fly line loading. Well, after the 4 months of school, they did not give you a choice. I ended up in weapons loading section, loading fighter aircraft, which was where I'd rather be than just maintaining it in a shop. That didn't sound like fun. I wanted to be out there with the airplanes. So from there, after leaving Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado, and after completing the 4 months of training, they gave us a 30-day leave prior to our next assignment. So I went back to Florida to visit family and enjoy my 30 days leave. At that point, I had been given orders to report to an F-111 squadron in Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico. So I drove out there and reported to the squadron commander, and he said, well, you're now at Cannon Air Force Base, one of the first F-111 squadrons. The only problem is we don't have any F-111s and may not get them for several months. But we do have mock-up training, and you'll go through that. So I went through the mock-up training for somewhere between 30 and 60 days, I guess, and completed all that on the F-111 systems and loading them and everything. Still, we didn't have any airplanes. So the squadron commander said, we're going to farm you folks out to different squadrons and around the base just to give you something to do till these airplanes arrive. And he said, we're not sure exactly when they're going to be here. So he said, if any of you know of any squadrons needing people, let us know and we'll send you there. Otherwise, we're going to pick where you're going to be working for the next month or two. Well, I had been a lifeguard in civilian life, so I went over and talked to the sergeant in charge of base, I guess you would say recreation, morale. I think is what they call
welfare
it.
Morale, welfare, and recreation.
Yeah, morale, welfare, and recreation. And he said, sure. He said, this particular summer we're looking at saving money and using military lifeguards for the first time. I said, yes, sounds great. I've got a job for at least a couple of months. I said, they may pull me back when the planes come in, but sounds good. So he called the base commander. I had a job at the swimming pool, and life was good that summer. This would have been the summer of 1968. Well, I ended up completing the whole summer there on through middle of August. And still no F-111s, but here comes duty orders for Benoit Air Force Base and Benoit Republic of Vietnam. And I go, my goodness, I haven't even seen an F-111. We're going to have F-111s when we get over there. Oh, no, son, you're not going to have F-111s. You're going to be on what's called the Tweety Bird, the A-37 made by Cessna. And we're going to send you TDY to England Air Force Base in Alexandria, Louisiana for 90 days to train on this airplane. You'll enjoy it. So another 30-day leave because that this is, I guess, standard practice. Although I hadn't earned it, they said, go ahead and take it because you're going to be going to Vietnam. You'll need it. So took some more leave and showed up at England Air Force Base for TDY. And in 90 days, we were well-trained. A little A-37 is a very easy jet to load as compared to some of these more technical, high-tech fighter jets. So after 90 days, they said, you guys are going as a squadron, pilots, all your gear, your toolboxes, you're going to be picked up here on the flight line at about 1 o'clock in the morning by a Continental Airlines jet that we've contracted to take you to Vietnam. Well, sure enough, here we are in our fatigues, pilots, crew chiefs, weapons people, we've all got our tools, and we're sitting in this hangar, and up taxis this big Continental's airline with a civilian crew. Didn't realize that'd be the last round eyes I was going to see for a while. So they picked us up in the middle of the night, and we flew with several stops along the way, including Hawaii, but never letting us really depart the airport. Every time we stopped, it was just to refuel, get off the plane, stretch your legs, and right back in. And I remember that we were coming into Benoit there at Vietnam just about dusk, just a little bit of daylight. And as we were coming in, he's telling us we're coming in, and as soon as we get on the ground, we don't want you to delay. This is a war zone, subject to being shot at or whatever, he said. So we want you to park the plane quickly and go over to this area where you're going to be briefed as to what's going to go on. Well, as we're coming in on final, the next thing I know, I hear the gear go up and the throttles go forward, and we decided to go around. And I knew we weren't in rough weather, and the pilot calls back and said, we're receiving small arms fire off the end of the runway. I'm going back around. And I'm thinking, well, I got a civilian crew. They must be paid very well from this. And we talked to the stewardess, and they said, yes, we are paid very well to take on these kind of flights. I could see why after that. Came back around, and we were able to land, I guess, after they said the Army dumped some artillery shells over in that area and quietened it down, so we landed. And again, we got off the plane, got in this area, open air area, and they briefed us if the siren goes off, hit the ground right where you're at and all this. And I thought, there really is a war going on here. This is real. This is not play anymore. So they bust us across base to our barracks in the middle of the night. And, of course, you can't see anything. You really don't know where you're at because you haven't seen really daylight yet. But you know that this doesn't look like any other Air Force base you've been on. The buildings look different. A lot of them had a French look, which I found out later were built by the French. Anyway, we get to our barracks, and they assign us our beds, and they said, try to get some sleep. I'd been asleep maybe an hour or two in a really deep sleep. Didn't realize that about 100 feet outside my barracks, on the other side of some Constantine wire, was a Vietnamese artillery battalion with 155-millimeter howitzer sitting over there. This thing fired off about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and literally caused that wooden barracks to sway. And I was on the bottom bunk, and I seems like I was like a cat hooked to the top bunk springs. I mean, I came up out of that bed, and it scared me to death. And, of course, the guys that have been there a while knew that this was coming, and they are just laughing at all us new guys that have come in country and going, that's outgoing. You guys will learn the difference between incoming and outgoing. Don't worry about it. Go back to sleep. So next morning I realized, could see it over there, and thought, oh boy, this is going to be fun right next to these guys for the next year. But you did. You learned to be able to sleep through all that. Well, that was in December of 69, probably around the 12th of December when we landed there. So I'm in country a couple of weeks, and it's Christmas time, and that is one lonely, miserable time to just have left home. But I can say that the guys had been there a while, made it as pleasant as they could. It was definitely a light show in the sky, because every type of artillery or fireworks or flare that I think the U.S. government had, our guys were firing it off on Christmas Eve just to celebrate Christmas. I mean, the sky lit up. And it was pretty. And we celebrated, but next day we're back down on the runway loading. And what I found interesting, we're loading these little A-37 jets, which are very, very simple. And then, but you knew that there was a truce during the holidays, and we weren't supposed to be bombing. Well, what they would do would be go up before the holiday along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and we would arm these fuses with like a 36 or 24-hour delay in these bombs. We had delay fuses we could use. So we were dropping them the day before along the trail, and they were going off on the holidays, but we weren't out there bombing. We were observing the truth. And some of them were even pressure sensitive, just waiting for someone to come down the path, you know, walking along or trucks. But we were still had the day off. So that was the way, I guess, the military had learned to get around some of the truce, where we could still have a day off and observe it, but still the enemy give them a hard time. But basically, we were very lucky at Benoit. A lot of the bases over there and the guys that I talked to were working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. For some reason, unknown to me, we were at like 120% manpower. And they said, first of all, they knocked us down from 7 days a week to 6 days a week, and then pretty soon we were down to 4 days a week. When I say 4 days a week, that's working a straight stretch and getting one day off. So they are pretty much most of the time I worked 4 days, one off, and four more days. And due to the extra manpower we had, that made that very pleasant over there. Oh, there was not a lot to do on your days off. Going to the base exchange where it was air-conditioned, because our barracks weren't air-conditioned, the middle of the day on the second floor in these old screen and wood barracks, that's pretty intolerable without a fan up there. So you go to the base exchange and stand there and read magazines and the air conditioning, or you go to the movie, you know, and sit in the air conditioning, something like that. But you have to retreat to those air conditioned places typically on your days off. On some of my days off, I kept thinking, here are all these helicopters flying around and stuff, and I'd really like to get up and just see the countryside. Well, someone mentioned, I guess they had done it, that if you go over across the street, and again, we had a howitzer howitzer gunnery battalion that was Vietnamese on one side of the fence, but right across the road from me was an Army aviation battalion of helicopters. And every morning these helicopters leave and they come and go all day long. And of course, anytime you've ever heard anything about Vietnam or any sounds, all you hear is the thumping of these blades. It's common over there all the time. Well, I learned that if you go over there and the base of the tower and you tell the tower that you'd like to go to Saigon or somewhere on a ride, if they have a non-combat helicopter going somewhere, like a mail run or something, they'll take you. So I thought, okay, and the guy said, you may have to wait here half a day or an hour, he said, but if I have one, I'll let him know. Finally, one came along. He was running mail up to Saigon, about 15 miles north of us. He said, sure, I'll give you a ride. Well, this was not an approved Air Force thing to do. I was just over there doing it. Had I been caught, I would have been in trouble and probably busted. But He gets me up to Saigon, and I said, when are you going back? He said, oh, no, I'm going on out in the countryside, and I'm not going back. You'll have to go over here, check in, and see if you can get a helicopter back. And I thought, oh, my goodness. I have to be at work at 8 o'clock the next morning, or they're going to know I'm AWOL, and I'm in Saigon with no approved papers to be off the base. Well, I finally found a pilot that was getting ready to go out, and he said, well, I'm not going to the air base in Benoit, but I'm going to the Vietnamese Army side, which didn't have a gate and was a lot of Constantine wire between us and them. He said, I can get you that close. I said, if you can just get me that close, somehow I'll find a way to get back on this air base. Well, he drops me off, and I can see my barracks, but like I said, there's a lot of barbed wire and landmines between me and my part of the base, and no way to get there without going around and going through the air police at the front gate, which I would immediately be caught and in trouble. So another helicopter pulled in, and this one was carrying some high-ranking officers, and it was a pretty plush Huey. So you could tell this was one of their command Hueys. So this guy, he never shut down. He was running, and he let these guys off, and I ran out there, and I asked him to lean over, and I whispered to this young pilot, who was probably about my age. I think I was about 21 or 22 at the time, and he's probably the same age. And I said, look, that's my barracks over there. I'm going to get busted if I don't get on that side of the base. Can you just lift me across the fence and let me get off? He looked at me. I said, you don't. I said, I'm in trouble. He said, hop in. And he said something on the radio, which I couldn't hear. He literally lifted right across the top of my barracks and sat down in the middle of that aviation battalion. I got out, I saluted him and said thank you, and he went, gave me the thumbs up and saved my day. But I also, after that, I didn't really learn my lesson because I enjoyed flying so much. I ended up befriending a Vietnamese captain who I, to this day, wish I'd written his name down because I do not remember and do not know if he ever survived the communist takeover. But I befriended this captain, and the A-1 Sky Raiders are what they flew, which typically a one-seater, but they have a G model, which they call the Blue Room, that has two seats side by side. I guess they used that for training at one time. So I would tell him what days I had off, and he said, I will try to get a G model that day. And he said, you ride with me on those days if you like. And I said, oh, I would like that very much. He said, I let you fly some too, because I told him that I had, you know, private or a student pilot's license. He said, I let you fly some. And so sounded great to me. I said, you know, I'm not approved to do this. Well, you don't tell anybody. You come fly with me. Okay, so I go over there and sit in their officer's shack over there and have a Vietnamese Coca-Cola with them, which tasted a little different than our Cokes, even though it was Coca-Cola. It, I guess, was made with their water. It had a different taste. But anyway, and he said, okay, we're leaving at such and such a time. Go out and get in the airplane. I'm going to pre-flight it. Well, I never really gave it much thought on my first mission with him. And I did several missions with him. But on the first one, I forgot, we're going to taxi right down where I work, right among all the airplanes and down the flight line where all my guys are on the other side of the base. Because the Vietnamese pilots were on, the Air Force was on one side of the base and the American Air Force was on the other side. Sure enough, I get in there and here we go. I can see my guys down there. And, of course, I'm sitting there with this canopy back, sitting, you know, blowing the breeze. But I did have a helmet on. So I kind of slid down in the seat, and I rolled my sleeves up so that you couldn't see, you know, my stripes. And you really couldn't at that point tell if I was American or not. So I slid down in there right past the guys I work with. And we taxied right on the end of the runway, and we took off. And during those different rides with him, and, of course, we're fully loaded with bombs and ammunition, and we're flying with two other airplanes, and we're flying what he called either loose formation or tight formation. Now, he would not let me do tight formation, but if we were flying loose formation, he let me fly. Mm-hmm. And there's certain ways you do a turn in formation to keep out of the prop wash. He taught me how to duck under the prop wash and let me literally fly the plane. Well, we're down in the Mekong Delta one day, and forward air controllers mark the Vietnamese down there in the trees, which we can't see them. All we see is his smoke. He's telling them on the radio to drop their bombs 100 meters north or south or whatever of this smoke. This is where the enemy is. So these guys, of course, I'm not flying. This time the Vietnamese pilot's flying. And they're flying in formation, one right after the other, diving straight down, pulling out, seemed like about, I want to say about 6 G's we were pulling on the pullout. It was, the G's were phenomenal in that little prop job Sky Raider. But to the point my eyeballs would close and the camera in my hands would literally go to my lap. I couldn't hold it. And then as we would come out and the G's would drop down, and I was trying to watch that G meter. Then I could see again, and we'd come back, level off, and fly a circle. And all three of these planes did this till they had exhausted all their ordnance, and then we'd fly home. Well, on the way home, he would always let me fly, and he taught me how to do aileron rolls, and he didn't mind. And you know, to take this thing down, drop it 10 degrees, pick up airspeed, and then kick the rudder and kick the stick over. And I had the best time. That was more fun. And I couldn't believe that I'm doing this in a war zone. And here I am in an ejection seat, never been trained for ejection. He's got a 45 on his side. I've got nothing. And all he says, if we have to bail out, tuck your arms in and pull these pins and do this and that, and we're going to be out of here. Well, having worked around fighter jets and knowing what they could do and how the ejection seat worked, I thought, I can probably get out of this alive. I don't know if I'll be alive when I hit the ground, and I probably will never live through the experience, but I think I can get out of the airplane alive. But thank goodness that never happened. A lot of times these oil warning lights, these old A1s were old, and these old oil warning lights would come on and different things, and I'm thinking, oh, gosh, you know, the engine's going to shut down. He'd bang on the panel and go, ah, no worry. And we keep going. And I had watched some of these old A1s come in and the landing gear not go down and then belly, because their maintenance was probably not up to the United States Air Force maintenance. And so they were kind of held together questionably. But at least everyone I was in and every trip I took came back very successfully, no problems at all. But those were good times. I got a lot of great pictures that they're on slides of our bombing missions and other Vietnamese pilots, you know, in close formation, and got to meet these guys. And they were very proud, and even though I was just enlisted and they were Vietnamese officers, they were very accommodating, and just the fact that we wanted to be with them and acknowledge what they were doing seemed to be very pleasing to them. That was really the highlight of my time in Vietnam.
How many missions did you fly?
I would say in the neighborhood of about 10.
And I was wondering, did they have a problem size-wise getting to the controls? Because they're smaller people. Did they have booster seats or blocks on the pedals?
Yeah, blocks on the pedals. Okay. I never saw any other assist other than blocks on the pedals. And he was probably about 5'4", mm-hmm. I'm guessing. The size of this fellow, probably in the neighborhood of 125, 35 pounds. But did have blocks on the pedals, I noticed. But that I was amazed at how powerful that radial engine is on that A1 prop airplane. Those were World War II, I guess, vintage aircraft, I believe.
Yeah, they're the R-3350. It's an 18-cylinder, 3,000-horsepower engine. It was.
I saw one day one of the pilots throttle one up, and he sent one of the ground crew rolling down the ramp.
Yeah.
That was behind it. So they're quite powerful. Yes. And I could tell from doing these aileron rolls how strong and powerful this airplane was. Mm-hmm. Different than any Cessna trainer I'd ever had my hands on. But after being there 9.5 months, we got word that Nixon is cutting back on the troops and starting to pull people out of Vietnam early. So in 2 more weeks, they said, you're going to be leaving, which didn't upset me. I was pretty much glad to get out of there. You know, it seemed like I'd been there forever. The United States was starting to seem like a dream. And so at the end of 10 months out of a 12-month tour, I was on a commercial airplane. I think it was Tiger Airlines or something, another military contract airline, on my way back to the States. And that was a great experience to set foot on American soil again. I remember getting out, we left Benoit late in the afternoon. We refueled in Japan somewhere in the night, and they didn't even let us off the plane. They had to shut the air conditioners down. They just opened the doors, and all of us, and we're still in fatigues. We're all hot and sweaty, still in fatigues in this thing. And we got a good tailwind coming across the Pacific, so we went nonstop from Japan to Seattle, Washington. We were supposed to stop in Alaska, and they said, we have such a great tailwind, we're going all the way to Seattle, which we did, and most of us got off that plane and kissed the ground. And I remember they let us off the plane. I went up to the bar, and I said, do you have any white bread? I want some bread, and I want some milk. Because everything had been pretty much powdered or bread was stale, and they had that. And I think after I had that, I had a beer. But it was great to be back in the States. And from there, we went to the East Coast. I think it was McGuire Air Force Base, I believe, in the
New Jersey
area. And then I hopped a private flight back to Florida. At that time, I was engaged when I went to Vietnam. So coming home early, I was going to get married, and my fiance was very happy about that. And I ended up on that 30-day leave getting married and reporting to my next duty station, which was Eglin Air Force Base in the Panhandle of Florida. It was my third choice. I had chosen MacDill as my first choice because coming from Vietnam, they try to give you your choice. MacDill was closer to, in Tampa, closer to Orlando, and that was number one. Homestead in the Miami area was number two, and Eglin was number three. But Eglin was a great place. I thoroughly enjoyed my 18 months there. It was just a great time there on the Gulf. And at that time, I was assigned to an F-4 squadron, and the last time I had seen an F-4 was at Lowry Air Force Base in training, where we trained to load on F-4, but I had not seen one since. So I've got this crew that's never been to Vietnam yet, but yet they have all the F-4 experience, and I'm now their load crew boss. So I've got three guys working for me, and they know far more about this airplane than I do. So it took me about 90 days to get up to speed on the F-4. And all we were doing was training pilots up there in the Eglin area. Did this basically for 18 months. The government came along and said, we'll give you a 90-day early out if you're going to school or if you want to be a police officer in Washington, D.C. Well, I didn't want to be a police officer in Washington, D.C., so I said, I'm going back to school. So I got out in June, early June of 1972. And that ended my 4-year stay with the United States Air Force. They do try to get you to reenlist. Had I had a job like air traffic controller or something that I really enjoyed, I probably would have considered staying. But as weapons loading, there wasn't a civilian job that you could transfer into it. I didn't see it as a real great opportunity, and I knew if, with Vietnam still going on, if I reenlisted, I was going back to Thailand or Vietnam. So those options weren't too appealing to me. Civilian life and school looked better at that time, so the federal government and I separated in good company with an honorable discharge, and that ended my military career till I, later on in the 70s, joined the Coast Guard Reserves out of Port Canaveral.
Oh. Let me ask you a question about how you got into munitions training. When you were in boot camp, I guess you take the standard tests, whatever they are. Why do you think you got munitions? Was that, did everybody get it? Was that the type of thing? Or?
Okay, the way this worked was when you enlisted, they gave you these tests to determine your capabilities. And there was like general aptitude, there was mechanical aptitude. Well, unfortunately for me, I guess I, for some reason, and I didn't consider myself mechanical, but I scored higher in the mechanical. And general was where I really would have liked to score because that's where medics and air traffic controllers typically came out of that group. But since I was higher in mechanical, when we went to basic training out there in Texas, they separated us into the groups as to how we scored best on these preliminary scores back when we enlisted. So they took all the guys that or tops in mechanical and put us in this room. And I thought, well, you know, there's some pretty good jobs out there, and there were some decent ones. Unfortunately, whatever was available that day, they put on the board. And therefore, may have been some great jobs, but if they weren't on that board that day, you weren't offered them. And I remember one was corrosion control. I thought, that sounds really good, you know. And somebody said, that's washing airplanes and painting them. You don't want to do that. And I said, no, you're, okay, sorry. And never realizing that the military would ever do anything to lead you in one direction or the other, this fellow stands up. How many of you like guns, liked to hunt and stuff like that. Well, I raised my hand. I had guns at home, liked to hunt. It was great. And you guys aren't afraid of weapons, worked around, you know, had them hunted and stuff. Oh, yeah. Well, you guys that raised your hand, come with me. I want to talk to you. We're going to go in here and talk about a career field in the Air Force that's totally voluntary. If you don't take this, you can come back and pick one of these other jobs on the board, which, again, none of those sounded very good at all. So he painted a very good picture about loading weapons on aircraft and how important it was and all of this. And I thought, well, gee, at least this is something, you know, you're selected for it. It was a nice rosy picture. I guess if there were worse jobs, matter of fact, I'd much rather been in weapons maintenance and loading than corrosion control. So I ended up going into that, and that's how I ended up in it. I never was afraid of those kind of things, and so many safeguards, it was all very safe anyway.
Did you ever have any accidents or incidents?
I had a very funny incident in Vietnam. You could call it an accident, although it was the safety factor on these bombs, general-purpose bombs, is very great. You could drop them out of an airplane. If you don't put a fuse in them, they won't go off. But the average person in the Air Force doesn't know that. Well, we're out there on a rainy night in Vietnam. It just, you know, raining, just steadily pouring down. But we're still loading aircraft. As long as it wasn't lightning, we're loading bombs. Well, we had what they call a jammer, this little mechanical lift vehicle that would come along and lift these bombs on these metal rollers. And, of course, it's a steel case on the bomb. And, of course, we even had the fuse in these. These were wired and fused and ready to be hung on the aircraft. Well, the table operator didn't have that table just exactly level. And we got this bomb up about 6 feet in the air, and it slid and fell off on this concrete and bounced about three or four times. There was a crew chief of the airplane in that revetment that evening, and the last thing I remember is seeing him running down the ramp. Not to be seen the rest of our time while we were working. Of course, we just picked it back up and kept going. But we were taught, you know, that they're filled with Tritanol, and it's very, very stable type of material. So we weren't worried about it. Matter of fact, even the guys that used to drop it, put them out there on the stands on the ramp so we could load them occasionally, actually drop one off a flatbed on the concrete. So it wasn't that big a deal. If it had been with it, we'd have wiped the whole base out.
Anything you want
to? You asked the question I was going to say about the safety issues. There had to be many safety issues built into procedures built into that business.
There were. The only thing that I loaded that was somewhat dangerous were these rocket pods, these 2.75-inch folding fin rockets, and they were generally shot out of a pod. And if you had any static electricity anywhere, and we always had to keep grounding ourselves, you could literally just static electricity fire off these things.
Oh, boy.
And those things, and of course, you always, when they were loaded, those things are always pointed somewhere where it won't be a problem. They'll go across a field or something. But I never had any, but I remember in Homestead there was an incident where they were loading and fired off a complete pod of those things across the runway out there. And luckily no one was hit or injured. But that was seemed to be the most dangerous thing. Other than that, we loaded the, over in Vietnam, we loaded the 750-pound, trying to think of those names. They're names you hadn't used in a long time, but it was the jellied gasoline.
Napalm,
yes.
Okay.
And we loaded that. Well, the napalm itself's pretty stable in these big aluminum canisters. It was the white phosphorus igniters that were very dangerous. And those things were kept very dry in a can. And, of course, the only way to stop white phosphorus is to cut the oxygen off. So we kept big barrels of water out there. So if we ever had one that was leaking, you just drop it down in the water and call ordnance disposal. But if that stuff got on you, it would literally burn a hole right through you. You'd have to submerge your limb or hand in the water to stop it or slow it down. But I never had that happen. But the white phosphorus igniters and those rockets were the things that we were really careful with. The general purpose bombs and the general napalm bomb, all that was actually very safe. Unless it was dropped on you.
When you said you worked one and four 4 and 1. How about shift work? Were you around the clock operation for the most part, and you'd get a mid watch every once in a while and a swing watch, so to speak?
It was an around the clock operation. Most of my 10 months in Vietnam, I think 8 of those 10 months were on day shift. We had less crews at night, but I did work a 2-month stretch at night. I didn't like it because sleeping in those second floor, those hot barracks with a fan blowing on you, was very difficult with people coming and going. It was much noisier. Nighttime was a much more pleasant time to sleep. But it was also pleasant to work on the flight line because it was cooler. So there was, I guess, trade-offs there. But I did do 2 months. I remember those rice bugs. We would all hop on these jammers that I told you about to load these bombs, and we had to go over to the next revetment where the airplanes were parked. We'd jump on this guy, and the guy driving it, here we go, about 25 miles an hour down the flight line. Well, these rice bugs look like an overgrown cockroach to me, and they flew, and they'd be around these lights at night. And I remember one hitting me so hard in the face one night, almost gave me a black eye. Yeah. Those big rascals, and of course, the Vietnamese eat those things.
Sure.
They just bite them, and I guess there was a lot of protein in there. There was another thing in Vietnam that was kind of funny, another incident. I was on the end of the runway one morning at the Arm and D-Arm shack, and one of the Vietnamese ground crew pulled up. He's a D-Arm guy like us to D-Arm his airplanes, and he had the best-looking submarine sandwich I've ever seen. Even though it was in the morning and I'd had breakfast, this looked like a rare roast beef sandwich. It looked excellent. I could see tomatoes and lettuce and all this stuff. And I said, "Oh, where did you get this roast beef sandwich?" He goes, "Not roast beef. Dog." I said, "That's no hot dog." He goes, "No, bark, bark, dog." And I went, "Oh," and he offered me some, and I did have to pass on that. But I be honest with you, it looked very good.
All right. Anything else you want to throw in? Oh, we do want to ask you about getting to Nassau County. How did that evolve?
I had retired from the Orlando Fire Department after a career there, and had gone back to school for a while. And my mother and father-in-law lived up here. And I had stopped in one time while we were here on vacation and saw the director of public safety and told him I was retired from the Orlando Fire Department. And he offered me a job. And I said, "No, I'm going back to school at this time. I'll appreciate the offer." Well, I continued on in this school for over a year and was not happy with this particular program. It had to do with working in hospital cath labs. And I got a call out of the clear blue. "I still have your application here. Would you like to come to work as a fire inspector, and over fire prevention for Nassau County? We're a little tiny department just getting off the ground." And I said, "A year ago I turned you down." And I said, "2 weeks ago I would have turned you down, but I'll take that job." And I did, and we ended up moving here to Nassau County in October of 92. And that's been a little over 15 years ago, and hopefully in a couple of years I plan on retiring for the second time out of the fire service.
That's great.
Well done.
All right. Thank you for sharing your recollections with us and for the benefit of our nation. And this will conclude the interview with Roger Henderson.
I see why you put this here, even though you